Who said wholesale should be an afterthought? Wholesale continues to be the most profitable investment channel for brands, accounting for an average of 60% of total company sales. That's why New Order by Lightspeed is bringing smarter B2B buying and selling to the forefront of brands and retailers' minds with a commerce platform that helps them grow and win together. Discover how New Order's wholesale and retail assortment solutions can help you compete thoughtfully and deliver exceptional buying experiences. Learn more at neworder.com. That's NUORDER.com. Thanks for tuning in to the Glossy Podcast. I'm your host, Jill Manoff, and today I sit down with Ricardo Lerude, co-founder and CEO of Lerude, the accessibly priced luxury quality shoe brand that emerged mid-pandemic and has since taken off, to say the least. Business is currently up 4x compared to last year, and the company is getting ready to open its second factory in Brazil to further fuel its rare vertical production. I wanted to ask Ricardo about his own career path, going from nearly two decades in the financial sector to shoes. I also want to get his take on the strength of the direct-to-consumer model and whether Lerude stores are actually soon to come. Welcome, Ricardo.
Thanks for having me.
You can tell by what I'm saying that I stalk the brand and you and your wife on Instagram. Tell me if there was an April Fool's joke that I fell for. It said, and I quote, P.S. Welcome to the podcast, Ricardo.
Thank you.
Excited to chat with you.
The April Fool's joke, it's been something we've been doing. I mean, we do it every year, so I guess next year people are going to be on the watch for that.
Yes.
But in one of our first years, we put a shoe up of Supreme as a collaboration with Supreme, and it looked like a real Supreme shoe.
It did.
And actually had like Footwear News call us and say, what's the story behind it? I said, guys, it's an April Fool's joke. And then they actually wrote an article, but they made it as clickbait. And then when you read the articles, it's, hey, it's actually a, you know, like guerrilla marketing that they do. But to this day, people bump into me and they say, oh, congratulations on the Supreme collaboration. It was a joke.
I mean, made a splash. Nice for other publications. They can leverage your joke, make it their own. I fall for it every time. I send it to my team. We have a little chat. How do we cover it? Do we cover it? So, yes, I fell for the Soho store announcement this year. And it said, just joking, coming soon. And is there a Miami store coming or what's happening in Miami?
That is true. And this is the thing we did last year, that we put like shoes with skates. And then the joke was that we're going to launch skates and everyone. But actually, we did launch skates with the collaboration with C7. But there is a collaboration that we're launching with the person that's from Miami. And we're going to have a pop-up there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's next month. So it will happen. We'll have physical store, a sales location for a while in Miami.
Fantastic. Let's circle back to the beginning. This is a pandemic baby, 2020. December, I believe, is the official launch time. And just prior, it was not that long before, I had Marina Lerude, your wife, on our podcast. She was heading up the Schutz brand at the time. And I mean, just a style maker in herself, having been the fashion director of Barney's and Teen Vogue and Style.com. She knows her stuff. But what was going on during the pandemic where you guys decided we're going to come together and do our own brand?
Yeah, there was a feeling when the pandemic and everything was really upside down. We didn't know when things were going to change. And I've been in a career, I worked for, big companies in the past, and she did too. And it just made us think that, like, if bad things happen, there's no safety by being, employed. Because when things happen, you can't control your future. You can't. So we were just looking at each other. We had kids at home, and we decided to let's take our future into our own hands. And we thought that there was something to do within the fashion space. We always thought that there's a lot of inefficiencies. So we started with shoes. It was one of these things that was natural. Marina had already been involved since the Barney's days and doing private label collection. And I think she felt it was one of these categories that for price point, that it was not a pleasurable experience to shop for shoes anymore, because you always felt like you're hurting for quality shoes. And we're like, I wonder if we can try to fill the gap. And I think so far it's been working.
Yes. So you're so right. And my gosh, let's talk price point. I think that most of your shoes are $300 to $500. I look back at Sex and the City days when they're like, I bought Manolo Blahniks and they were $400. And they're shoe shaming you for spending $400 on shoes. Manolo Blahniks are like four digits easy. Yeah? Tell me about this happy place.
Yeah, so that's exactly the point. And one thing that I think that there's a lot of people between the final customer and whoever makes the shoes. And then everyone, because everything in fashion is so volatile, everyone just tends to multiply by two, you know, the steps that they go. So you see from cost of production, people say, well, then you just multiply by seven, that's your retail. And then you try to sell it for that and then you run a discount. We thought, what if we just did it all? What if we just decided to cut the middleman and do it ourselves? And when we came out with like, well, we're going to price it this way, we'd have even some of our partners say, well, no, you should price it at 600. It's still a bargain for what you're doing. And I was like, am I leaving money at the table? And I was talking to an advisor of mine and said, listen, maybe you're going to have one of the new things, one of the novelties about what you're doing is your price point for the quality you deliver. So go with it. And I think it's been proven successful so far.
I would agree. Let's talk about I often hear, you know, successful brands, they happen to have a leader who's on the creative side, a leader who's more business-minded. Would you say that kind of perfectly sums up your partnership with Marina and how you work together?
100%. Not only that, it's not just about these two things. There's always a bunch of other talented people and the company is not too. So the whole business is formed that each individual talent can thrive. So my job is to make sure I'm like the super. So I need to make sure that the boiler is running, the hall is clean, people are getting paid, you're hiring the best people. You know, if we need the creative and we need to push on this or on that, I'm doing that part as well. So I'm basically creating the infrastructure for these creatives and these, you know, coders and people that, you know, do all several parts of the business to thrive. It is, that's why our slogan is you, us, we all. So it is about, you know, bringing through individuality, individual talents, a greater good. But if you look at all the very successful brands that happen, you can definitely track that they always had a business, someone that takes care of the business and someone that takes care of the creation part. They got to go together. If you just do the creation part, if you just do the fashion part, that is by nature a very hard thing to make money on because it changes every time. And usually you can make money by things that are repetitive, the things that become cheaper every day that you get to make them. So that's I think we built a system that gets better and better and quicker every time that we're doing things. That's my part is making sure that the system works and we pick the right partners and we structure our terms with these partners the right way.
Yes, got to talk about those partners. But you've since grown from a team of five to a team of 100 or 100 plus? Are you all, you're in this, I was commenting on your sexy office that is very much my style that I'm looking at in New York. Is everyone in New York or where is everyone located?
So we have about 120 people around the globe. We have in Brazil about 110 now. And we have three offices. So we have São Paulo, we have New York, and we have the South, where the city is called Sapiranga. In the South, we do all design and technical parts of the product and manufacturing. So you'll have around, call it 100 people there. In São Paulo is basically all the business support. So data, digital marketing, finance, customer service, you know, it's all done out of there. So we have about like 10 people there. And in New York, we have about 7 people, you know, and then we have some freelancers, you know, from Mumbai to LA, Milan, you know, we have employees in Milan. We were born out of Zoom, just like we're doing this podcast. So we manage the business a lot this way. I travel a lot too, but it is all over. It's 110, 120 people now.
Oh my gosh. I was going to ask if you're traveling all the time or digital technology has enabled so much.
I have to go. I go to Brazil once a month. Then I spend about a week there at least. Sometimes I spend 2 weeks. I mean, we started by placing orders into factories. And then slowly, you know, I learned, not slowly, I think quickly, I learned that the real value comes from the ability to develop your own products that are only yours and ability to do that quickly, and then the cost of doing it yourself versus someone else, and the speed, because they are based on orders. I am based on demand. So I plan how much leather I'm going to buy, not in an order that I got. I do it based on the, like a math around the thousands of orders that I get. So it's, you know, I'm managing through the data. So we had to build our own infrastructure to do that. I had to go a lot to Brazil.
Oh my gosh.
Spent a lot of time there.
Was that as daunting and wild of an experience as one would think? No, brands don't often do this. I can think of maybe one off the top of my head, which I know there are more, but like Lafayette 148, that's not a shoe brand, but like a luxury brand. I know they do this with internationally as well. They own their factory, but like, tell me about what goes into this and maybe what you wish you had known or what other people should know who are considering going there.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that if I knew really about the shoe business, I probably would have not gotten into it. You know, it's because it is a very complicated a part of the industry. But thank God it is complicated, because then it also makes it, you know, an industry that if you work hard and you're willing to solve problems, you probably get rewarded for them. I think that a lot of European brands actually do their own stuff. And a lot of the traditional that you see from you know, you say, oh, made in Italy or stuff that's like genuinely French, is because they actually control the production. If you look at LVMH, I think they own 11 you know, leather houses just on the leather side. So then they own not only the factories, but they own the supplies that go and they develop them themselves. So I think that the American approach to developing these brands is like, let's outsource this to Asia or the other places. You're basically just connecting an order from a wholesaler to a supplier of material. And then in a lot of these products, they kind of look the same. You just take the you know, you put a logo from one brand or the other on top. So we wanted to do things from the ground up that we could control and make. If we feel that the, you know, Marina tries every piece of shoe.
Nice.
Every one. And she tries them several times to make sure that they fit well. So we can alter it. It's like if you go to a factory that's ready to go into production, you can't just say, I'd like to make this like a millimeter wider.
Yeah.
We do that. You know, so that part was really when I think that the good brands actually take care of their own production. If you look at Birkenstock, they still make everything, and they make everything in Germany. 95% of everything they do is in Germany.
Yes.
And they still managed to grow 20% a year for the past 6-7 years.
So great.
And they managed to do, you know, margin expansion. It does work.
Yep.
You don't have to outsource things. I think that the things that matter, I mean, if you're making products to sell to a client, and the products really matter to you, you should probably try to make them, you know? So that's how we thought, and developing them. So that was the thought behind. That's what's hopefully going to create our competitive advantage for the future.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I was eliminating the conglomerates. I was like, when I was thinking of the brands that do this, but it's interesting. Would you go as extreme as wanting to, own your leather suppliers? Like, is that like a future?
I don't think we need to own 100%.
Yeah.
Because some things are actually commodities and you can find out there. But I should have the knowledge on how to develop things. So I started by just having 4 people. And when I arrived in the South, you know, maybe a year and a half after we launched, I think I had, you know, between 5 and 10 people in an office that would place orders into the factories. Today, I have one person that all that person does is develop leather in the tanneries that we go to. So there's a lot of it that we can have just the capability and the ability to change and alter and control the supply. But me having a small tannery and to be able to do some things that I'm the only one doing it in South America or in America. Yeah, for sure. I'm already looking into that.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, yeah. The things that matter, you should try to learn. And if you think it could be a competitive advantage, you should try to do it yourself.
For sure. Well, you started direct to consumer. I think you have got some retail partners now. What's the breakdown and what's the ideal balance as you see it?
Ideal balance, I think that just like the European brands, I think ultimately you should have the majority of your relationships direct to the consumer, be it stores or website. So I think that ultimately will be, you know, between 70 and 90% direct to consumer. That's where we, you know, we want to be. And I think that's where the most European brands are. But the demand that came from these partners last year, the year before, was faster than we were able to tell our own story on DTC or on like doing digital ads. But now we grow so much quicker online. So, not only we're vertically integrated in making the shoes, we're vertically integrated in making the ads that sell the shoes.
Nice.
So we have an in-house agency. We have a whole team of, you know, 9-10 people in Brazil that all they do is treat the images. We have a photo studio. We have people here that use photo studios. Even if we take a shot or we take videos here in the US, we'll ship them to Brazil and they get all treated, edited. All the stuff that you see on Labor Day, it's all done in Brazil. And it's actually the same building that we make the shoes. So if you think about how connected it is, you can have an idea in the morning, the shoe could be ready in the afternoon, you take the shot in the afternoon, by night it could be on the website, and you could be selling pre-order.
Fantastic.
And we've done some things this quick. That's the idea that we can do. We can connect the whole, you know, wheel of making and selling, which in a way, making shoes is hard. I kind of built a machine that can do them. But selling shoes is very hard. So now we're building the machine to sell the shoes. That's been our key growth driver. That's working.
Great. You guys get a lot of buzz and excitement around the comfort of your shoes. And tell me about, like, again, it reminds me of so many things are selling online that maybe you wouldn't think, like fragrance. You're not smelling it first, but you're not trying on the shoe first. Communicating fit or even dealing with returns, like, is that a constant conversation or how is that going?
So I think it's shoes is definitely a trust business. So if you definitely want to have 3 wows to be successful. You want to have, you know, the client look at the shoe and say, wow, I like this. That's the first wow they want to have. And the second one is when they get the shoe and then they feel like they got a good deal. It smells good. They're like, oh, this is nice. And then the third one is after they've worn it for a month and they're like, this is my favorite shoe. The moment you get these 3 wows, you can sell infinite shoes. I'm not sure what shoes you're wearing right now, but if you look at your closet, you'll see that the moment you find a brand that you like, you'll definitely sell many more to the same client. And we see this on our own website. We've been growing, you know, 4 or 5x, depends on the month. But the percentage of people that are buying from our website alone that we already knew that are ex-clients, it's north of 20%. So that is a massive number. That's one of the things that when we talk to people that, you know, are interested about knowing more how we do things is you guys have a very high repeat client base. And the fit thing, you know, I have many technicians now and trying them on, and a shoe that's a size 5 is completely different than a shoe that's a size 12. To be able to scale that up and down, it's one of the things that I didn't know it was that hard. And we don't get it right every single time, but we will. You know, the whole idea is that we are going to be better and better, and that people know, you know what, if you buy a 6.5 for Labor Day, I know it's a 6.5. And the same way I do for Nike. I mean, I just know my size and I can just buy. No question.
Yes. Well, I will say that you guys do it up. Everything has a high-end feel, from the photography to I am an early Labor Day customer where I've got the gingham kitten heel type with the bow. Anyway, the fact of the matter is you get the box. It's everything. It feels good. It's got the shoe bag. It's just, anyway, it's a luxury type of experience. What are you experiencing in terms, is this a luxury customer who's maybe trading up? Like, right? It's not econ. Who is she?
That's a good question. It's a good question because the way we price it is really this white space. And by definition, the white space should not exist, because if it existed, someone would have done it already. But so we range. We get clients from both ends. I guess it's like the Uniqlo when they came into cashmere. Who's buying Uniqlo cashmere? It's everyone. It's the person that used to buy Loro Piana. They buy now Uniqlo because they want to buy each color. And they get the person that was buying like just normal Gap sweaters. And they're like, you know what? I want to have something that feels nicer. So we get both ends. It's a broader set of customers. And a lot of people ask us about the demographic and who's coming and who is buying from us. And we tend to think, you know, we don't like to box ourselves into just a specific demographic. It's about people that are going on dates. It's about people that are going to job interviews. It's about people that are going to church, picnics. It's occasion based, and it's feelings that you want to have when you wear those shoes. And it should be a budget that should fit most people. It is $300, still, you know, an expensive acquisition, but it's definitely, it's something that people can afford.
We'll be right back after this quick break. Who said wholesale should be an afterthought? Wholesale continues to be the most profitable investment channel for brands, accounting for an average of 60% of total company sales. That's why New Order by Lightspeed is bringing smarter B2B buying and selling to the forefront of brands and retailers' minds with a commerce platform that helps them grow and win together. With New Order by Lightspeed, buyers and sales reps are empowered with data, powerful integrations, and features that eliminate hassles in the market-to-order process. This platform allows them to focus on what truly counts, delivering the right products to the right customers at the right times. What started in 2011 as a sales rep tool to help brands process orders right on a trade show, market, or showroom floor has evolved into a full commerce suite trusted by over 3,000 wholesale brands and 500,000 retail buyers, as well as some of the largest department stores in the world. Now they help companies all across the world process tens of billions in gross merchandise volume every year. Discover how New Order's wholesale and retail assortment solutions can help you compete thoughtfully and deliver exceptional buying experiences, driving more sales, higher sell-through, and fewer markdowns. Learn more at neworder.com. That's NUORDER.com. Well, what, speaking of acquisition, what's working to acquire customers now? Are you using, is it all digital advertising? And I know that you've done some sexy collaborations with the likes of Altazara and Barbie. And also, I mean, I see on your Instagram, like, who are you doing a lot of gifting? Because I see everyone, or from Blue Ivy to Carly Kloss, everyone's wearing your clothes or your shoes.
We do the seating, we call it. It's not a gift, you know. It's a, you know, we have an office here for like press, in particular in like VIPs, that we understand. Marina started her career as a stylist, so she was in a magazine, and she understands very well the demand and how these people work. And we have a very good system of making sure that whoever needs a shoe that's going to be an evidence to us, they get it quick. And we're sure that people are, you know, they have good relationships with the people that are dressing these folks. So we do that a lot. And then we work that on the VIP level and like magazine level. And then we built that for, you know, influencer and like in a broader market. So we do that seeding, which is a very effective way. But what we're finding is that the scalability of that, I mean, I think we've done as good as a job as we could have. But the next phase, or the future, will be from keeping that and then getting the most amazing ads and then putting money behind them. Because the more we keep working and we look at the data and we look at the things that work for us to do these ads, we can do more and we can spend more money and raise spend. They need to feel like you're not looking at a commercial. They need to feel nice. They need to feel like you're flipping through a magazine at a doctor's office and you see an editorial. And you're fine with it, like as you're catching up on your social feed. That's how we think about the ads that we do.
Is it all Instagram?
We do most of it. It's Meta that we're doing now. But since it's working there, we're ramping up for Google. Google, it's just different. It's a less social Google. And we're expanding to other platforms as well. The other thing that's interesting is the collect thing, because it's working really well for Lariday, but as we, I don't know if you realize, but we did the we launched Collect,
yes,
which is a multi, yes.
Your marketplace, yes. Typo, is that the business, yes, model of this vertical?
It's a marketplace. It's and in a way, it's, you know, going back to Marina's roots again of Barney's, you know, that, you know, you should feel that you can go to the second floor or third floor, you had the shoe floor, but you did walk through the first floor, that you had jewelry, you had bags, you had other things there. And we launched that, and we think we have a great selection. It's fun to go browse, and that represents about 10% of our sales, in a month already.
Oh, wow.
And we see enormous potential there. So we're going to start doing ads and managing. So these brands are like, why should I sell it with Lariday? So because you're going to sell a lot more, because we can actually put this whole look together.
Yes.
And then when we place these ads or we run this content, you could get the whole thing. You can get the shoes, you can get the jewelry, you can get the dress. So it becomes a lot more effective advertising, because you can get customers that are looking for different things.
That is so smart. I wasn't thinking to put the full look together in your ads. Brilliant. Shop now.
Thank you.
When you click on an Instagram post with that full look, will it go to one page featuring just that look?
So that's going to be launched very soon. Ooh. But when you go into our the page that has the shoe that you clicked, yeah. The suggestions at the bottom already show the dress and they show the jewelry. But that's the whole idea.
Take notes, folks. This is fun. Anyway, I like that. Do you and Mervina own the company? Have you got investors involved?
No, we own outright. I mean, we got like a friends and family round in the beginning, a safe. I think the whole amount that went in was $1 million. And we do give stock to employees. I mean, a lot of people that whoever's building significant value gets a little piece, you know, of equity. Some people are doing well now, but it's us. We don't have institutional capital behind. I mean, we're thinking if we should do that in the future or not. We do the whole idea that we're doing this for us and how we think that this company should be in 50 years from now. I think it allows us to build it right. So there's no rush. There's no, you know, we have our own rush, but it's not, we're not doing it for other people. We're doing it for us.
Yes. Do you have a specific 5-year plan or where do you see the business going in the short term?
So I think that Labor Day is gonna have a great summer. I mean, we're going to be at 93 Nordstrom stores now. We're growing stores at Bloomingdale's as well. So that's going to give us another visibility. I think we had a very strong spring and high summer collection, and we're doing great on an early numbers here. So I think there's a lot of growth for our brand in the U.S. alone. And I think from there, we're going to be thinking about how do we deal with sneakers? How do we deal with the, you know, men's side as well? And then what are the other categories that we'd like to get in? And it doesn't have to be Labor Day. The whole idea is that we, you know, it should be that the next things that we do, I don't believe that, you know, a brand should try to tell every story out there. Just like the Europeans, they don't try to get, like Polo tells every story from sheets to teddy bears to, you know, everything. And I think that the houses in Europe, they allow each brand to tell a different story. So there might be derivatives of the Labor Day brand.
Cool.
Just, I think, you know, when I look at Miu Miu, I feel it's Prada. Everyone knows it's Prada.
Yeah.
But it's Miu Miu.
Yeah.
You know, so... So maybe that's the direction that we might go.
I was going to ask if men's is coming. Ooh.
It is coming. Let's see. I do have plans. I do want to have, there is a particular set of product that I'm looking for that I can't find for the price I want. And I can make women's shoes. So maybe I'll just get, but it'll be less wide. It'll be just a very focused effort for getting a very good piece of footwear for men's. And let's see what we would call it.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I have a fun question for you. What are the secrets of working with your spouse and not killing each other? I'll put it that way.
I think you need to set the boundaries well at work. You need to say, so you do this and you do that. And you just got to be professional when you're at work. I mean, it's just like you there's certain rules that you should imagine that everyone else that's around you is not family. You know, they're investing their careers around you. So I guess you just got to have a sense of responsibility that you got to be professional. And if you don't get into each other's way of their day-to-day job, I think you just got to set yourself apart. But it is not easy. You know, I mean, the thing is, it's hard for us to relax. I mean, we're, you know, from 6 o'clock in the morning until 11 at night, you get to have the two most important people in the company talking about work. Usually people go home. And so you miss a few hours of work. But at the same time, it's tiring for us because we're always talking about work. But the business feels, it's like a third child. So for us, it's not, we don't feel bad about it. It's like, we like talking about it. But it's a day-to-day thing. And I think setting, you know, boundaries on who does what clearly and teaching people around that's a Ricardo thing, that's a Marina thing, that is a good thing.
Yes. I mean, we talked about a couple of challenges today, but is there something specific that's weighing on your mind? Maybe something you're looking to crack and it's, I don't know, it's coming. You're figuring it out.
Like as a challenge for, like we're a multinational startup with 3 offices. connecting the three is very hard for me because it's different cultures, even from São Paulo to the South. There's a language barrier, culture barrier. So those three things is hard. The second thing is that we grow very quick. And sometimes the individuals can't grow as fast as the company has been growing. And we need to upgrade management. We need to, you know, build functions. We need to install systems that, you know, people that were part of the beginning, they just can't keep up. So that's a challenge for me, is like the most important thing at the company is the people, because it's just a bunch of people looking at screens and trying to do the same thing and taking care of the, like, it moves very quick. Like we do, the company does things very differently within 3 months, 4 months. You know, I went to Brazil, I decided to open the factory. It was November. By February, we had the building, the machines in there. And by April, we inaugurated it. So it is a pretty fast paced environment. So that's kind of like connecting and building the business. That's something that it is my, you know, one of my challenges that I have here. The second thing is, you know, what happens from now? This is, I don't think it's a challenge, but it's a thing that I've been thinking of, because Labrador feel it's going to feed itself, and the growth is, there is a snowball thing that had happened. I might have created something that will go on its own. So then how am I going to use this machine that was built for Labrador, this road? What cars do I want to put in this road? Do I want to own those cars? Do I want to rent the road to someone else? But it is that's what I've been thinking about now.
Well, you're making some smart moves. Well, how do you talk about with your rapid growth? How do you speak about growth versus profitability? Is it a profitable company? Is that coming?
Now, of course it is. We didn't put money in, like, it is. That's how I pay my bills. There's no concept of like not being profitable. The one thing is that we, and that's the thing I feel that we, you know, I was able to teach early on most people in the company, we think in unit economics. Everyone here thinks in, you know, pairs of shoes. So everyone in the company knows what the cost to make a pair is, what it is to fly a pair, what it is to ship a pair to the client's home, what it is on marketing per pair. So we've always been profitable. It's not, you know, I can't imagine someone that goes into the business saying, I'm not profitable now. Obviously, we had overhead that until you got like a minimum amount, you couldn't cover it. But yeah, it is a profitable company. I mean, I can't imagine. It couldn't exist if it was any other way.
Yes. Oh my gosh. You taught me some things today. I didn't know that wholesale markup is 7x typically.
Well, from the cost, I mean, that's the rule of thumb that, by the way, looking from the outside, people say, well, okay, well, how much does this cost to make 10? Okay, retail is going to be 70. I was like, what? And sometimes it's more.
Shoot.
And that's what these DTC things that came in and said, well, we're going to not do that, and we're just going to sell directly so we can charge less.
Yep.
And in a way, Labrador did that. I mean, we replicated the quality that you can get in Italy, in South America. So we got the cut in costs, but we also allowed ourselves to go straight to the consumer. So it's kind of like Warby Parker, but we cut the cost as well. And we also, we own the factory. That's a big thing that for us, and we keep saying, like, the ability to design and do your own thing is massive. If you don't depend on someone else to develop your product, imagine if Tesla or Apple had to actually get someone to design the iPhone or design the car. Then you're just like, if it's all private label that some factory is making for you, your client can get that same product. Then it's very hard to differentiate yourself.
Yes. A lot of shoe brands are based in Brazil. Is there just a lot of like expertise and generational talent? Like, what's happening?
Obviously, there's a lot of cattle in Brazil. So that's one thing that starts from having the raw material. But the second is the region that there is, I think it's 800 million pairs that are produced in Brazil, which is like four times what produced in Italy. A lot of them are made in the south of Brazil, which is a lot of immigration from Germany and Italy went to. If you put Italians and Germans to make shoes, I think it's not a bad combination to make industrial production of shoes, you know, Italians and Germans. And a lot of them come from there. But the whole, when Nine West was created, you know, Vince Camuto and Mark Fisher, they really unlocked that potential. And America first was discovered Brazilian shoes when, you know, with Nine West. they sold the business. They eventually had a non-compete for a few years. They each opened their own business and made it all over again. But you know, in early 2000s, a lot of the production that used to be made in Brazil, they figured out they could make it even cheaper in China. So Brazil became, the demand for Brazilian shoes became orphan of, the Northern Hemisphere. But Brazil, you know, happily at that time was the middle class was growing very quick. So the middle class in Brazil actually started to consume all these shoes. But at this point, now that they're still, you know, cheaper to make shoes in Asia, and Brazil still has this installed capacity of millions of pairs. My project is, let's get the Italian craftsmanship, you know, the European approach, but the same cost, and deliver them for North America and for Europe. So the idea is to kind of try to rebring what like Nine West was able to tap back in the day, but for a higher quality that you can get out of China.
Right on. Nine West, blast from the past.
Yeah. I mean, I think at one point they were responsible for 25% of the shoe exports from Brazil.
Wow.
And if this region alone that we produce, it's 400 million pairs a year. By the way, when I get to 1 million, I'll be massive, I'll be big, and I still will be nothing to what they do there. I in a way, I'm not even entering this I'm creating my own ecosystem. I want to have my own tannery. I want to import stuff from Italy, from India, from China. And I want to have my company, my people. The people are the biggest, assets that I can have. And I have internal training, and people get better in schools, and, you know, people are proud to work at Laverde.
Yes. I read somewhere that you make, tell me if I got it right, 200,000 pairs per year. And you have the capacity, I would assume, with your two factories, or maybe this is with the original factory, to make a million.
We want to get to a million. So we produce at our own factory. We're now close to signing a lease that will give us our second one, which is a bigger building. But we do work with three other factories. So the idea is that we're going to increase our internal production. But even if we work with other factories, I still develop everything in-house, and I deliver them. And then I have one of my representatives at the factory to make sure that it's done our own way. But we're going to bring more internal. But today, if I wanted to produce a million a year right now, I tap one of my factories is massive. They can produce, not for me, I'm not using that, but they can produce 7,000 pairs a day.
Wow. Fantastic. Well, I know that you just came out with your largest collection of 150 styles, which is exciting.
Yes.
I don't know if shoes are a seasonal business, but assuming that sales are going well, I have to ask, are you selling a pair of Western boots? Is that a hot, what's hot right now?
We've always had the Western boot. But I don't feel on my screen that that's like really picking up. I mean, obviously the song and everything that's happening. But we are, it is our largest collection, and I think it's one that's been going really well. We also have our core styles, you know, really picking up. So, you know, we ended up creating these families of like the Milan, which has the metal, on top of the sandals. We have, you know, the Dolly family, and some of these are becoming like staples that people just want to have it in different colors and different finishes. And those are really picking up. So, you know, Laverde is becoming a brand and ends up having these families that can work as brands. So you have the Milan family, which is the one with the hardware. You have the Dolly, which is the whole thing. You have the High Dolly, the Low Dolly. We have the Annie. We name the shoes. A lot of it, we try to pick up from how Nike does it. You know, there's the Air Jordan. There is the Dunk Low. So Laverde, we hope to have these brands that became from the products, and then these products become families. That's the idea on how we're developing this work.
You're doing something right. You say Dolly and I can picture it now. It's cute. Oh, get it? Well, it's hot. Well, Ricardo, thank you for being here. We covered a lot of territory. Thanks for being open, honest, all the things. This was great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's all for this episode. Our theme music is by Otis McDonald. If you liked this episode, be sure to share it with someone else you think would. Thanks for listening to The Glossy Podcast.